Excuse me. Good evening, everybody. Good to see you. Nice. You could join us from your room, Dave. Welcome. Welcome, everybody. So, in the fifth lesson, in 7.5 lessons about the brain, by Dr. Lisa Feldman Barrett. This chapter is all about how our brains influence each other. The previous chapter we looked at was really pretty far out, how our brains basically create reality, that our brains have the ability to create a predicted future reality that we experience as if it was really happening, which is all pretty mind-blowing. Since we think that's not what's happening, you know? We think we're experiencing what's happening now in real time and looking out at the objective world through the portals of our senses. But she painted a much more complex picture about the brain assembling reality as a controlled hallucination. And remembering that the overall theme of the book, her sort of root understanding of how the brain's working, is that it's all about our stability and survival, including our thinking, including our perceptions, including, of course, the regulation of the physiological systems of the body, that it's all of one piece, one big process. So that was pretty far out. But this chapter, on first glance, doesn't seem quite as far out. Like, we already know that we influence each other, right? That's pretty obvious. It feels pleasant to be with people we enjoy, you know. And we are aware probably of some of the physiological aspects of that, that it's not just a pleasant emotion or a nice idea, you know. We've all noticed that we feel calmer and happier. Probably our blood pressure drops a little bit when we're hanging out with someone we enjoy. So what's interesting about this chapter is that, yes, this is obvious, but also that it goes much, much deeper than that, and that this influence between us is deeply powerful in a systematic way through our whole, all of our systems, both, and that can operate both in a positive direction and a negative direction, and that our propensity for this is not just a neat little extra thing, kind of cool, you know, but maybe actually quite fundamental to the efficiency of the system, so that over the long haul, you know, we're more likely to survive and reproduce, and the whole evolutionary idea is back again. So it goes really deep, is what she's pointing out, how deeply we influence each other, to the point where it starts to become a little dubious to think about ourselves as separate people. So this all sounds like Buddhism, right? But that when we're together, we're sort of not only operating an intense, incredibly complicated networked brain, I mean, but between us, we're also forming a certain kind of neurological network. So a few of the bits of evidence she presented around the positive side of this, a phenomena called co-regulation. One is that when you're with somebody you care about, your breathing often synchronizes, as well as the actual beating of your heart, you know, the rhythm and beating of your heart. And this is apparently not just that we feel in sync and in harmony, and that also expresses physically, but more like our brains now don't have to work quite as hard. Like, there's a little advantage if they can share the load of regulating even apparently automatic processes like breathing and beating hearts, that we're literally cooperating in the rhythm of breathing and the beating of the heart. And that makes it easier for both of us, so we use up a little less energy. So it's good. Another, and these are based on studies that she talks about in the footnotes, another is that people in loving and positive intimate relationships tend to have stronger immune systems and are literally less likely to get sick. And if you're already sick with cancer or heart disease, some other major ailments, you're more likely to get better if you're in a positive, loving, close relationship. And I'm not sure exactly how the studies defined what that relationship is. So somehow there, the two brains even help each other cope with the complex physiological processes of immune response, you know. It's crazy, really, you know. Not the way we think. A third is that if a loved one is in pain, I'd seen this one before, holding their hand reduces their pain. And again, we tend to be aware of these things, but the way we think about them from the point of view of the neuroscience that she's presenting is shallow. That we would think, oh, sure, it's reassuring when your loved one holds your hand, so you can kind of relax about the pain and it doesn't bug you as much. But no, she's saying you actually literally feel less pain. They put you in the brain scanner and look at whatever the neurological markers are of the pain response, and there's less. You're really, truly feeling less pain. There is less pain. And pain, it turns out, is much more complicated than just X amount of whack is Y amount of pain. It's also a situation that's being created by the brain to help us stay safe. There's some really interesting examples. It's pretty rare, apparently, but of individuals who don't feel pain, and all the, which is a problem, actually. It sounds good, but it's a problem because then they can't navigate the environment so well. And there's also tons of evidence that it works the other way too. That if we're with somebody with whom we don't feel safe or comfortable, our systems have to work extra hard, and that's bad for us. And the one we're probably all aware of is how vigilant our system is for threat, anything that's threatening. And the threshold can be pretty low. You know, that somebody looking at you funny, or just kind of pausing a little as they speak, or having a tone of voice can make you worried, make your whole system worried, so that you, right, so your heart rate goes up, your stress hormones are released, and you're on high alert. And this ties into the previous chapter, of course, because it probably the brain is predicting that this may be a situation where we need our resources primed so that we can survive. And the title of the chapter has an important point in it, too. The title of the chapter is "Your Brains Secretly Work with Other Brains." Secretly. So meaning we're not consciously aware of most of this that's happening. I believe our practice makes us a little more aware of some of it, you know, a little more in touch with our body and our emotions and shifts in our cognitive reality. But still, you know, again, back to this idea that the brain is kind of doing the whole thing here, according to this way of thinking. So the brain is not going to spend a lot of energy showing our thinking all these internal processes, right? Why would that be worth it, you know? Like, maybe from the brain's perspective, like, you are not that important of a person to explain all this to, you know? We just need you around for the things that being a person is helpful for, you know? So a lot of it happens in the dark. And one of the implications of this, which is really important to us, I think as bodhisattvas, which has come up a few times before, is that there's a social justice implication. Because our ability to do this co-regulation, the positive side of the equation, is developed through childhood. And remember how the parents or caregivers help the baby to figure out how to do stuff like attentional control and attentional filtering through this process of co-attention, looking at this and looking at that and making different sounds to the baby. So because of that process, we become initially attuned to people who are more like us and more like our caregivers, right? So more like our parents. Because these people who are more similar to us are much easier for our system to read and interpret and decide this is a safe person I can co-regulate with. And remember, this is happening often without our conscious awareness. So here we have a deep, sort of physiological, metabolic, even driver that separates us, that makes us more prone to hang out in our in-group, you know, with our tribe, with our ethnicity, with our political interest group, with our racial group. Because in this brain as body budget maintainer perspective, it's more expensive for our brain. It takes more energy for our brain to do the extra work of interpreting people we're not familiar with, who don't look like us, and trying to figure out what exactly the signals they're sending are so that we can do this co-regulation. So I find that in a way discouraging, like, dang, we're wired, you know, we're wired to create these separate groups according to this. But also in a way, it's kind of relieving, I think, because although it's, of course, our responsibility to learn about this stuff and figure out how we can connect with more kinds of people for all the reasons that we know about there, that one of the things that makes that harder is not because we're bad people or that we're, you know, particularly conditioned by racism more than anybody else, but through this neurological, physiological process of seeking co-regulation, which is more efficient and trying to avoid when it's harder to do. So here's where we do need our thinking, big thinking brains, right? Here's where thinking maybe helps us evolve in a social evolutionary way, not just a physical Darwinian evolutionary way, that we can understand this stuff. We can learn about this stuff as we're doing here and all the other ways you've done this, from all the other frameworks. And we can choose to have value systems. We can choose to study teachings on ethics and generosity, and can choose to study anti-racism and all the other isms. And we can choose to invest extra energy, you know, to do extra work, expanding the range of people that we can click with, that we can relate to. And she also presents that there's evidence that that does in fact work. And that was in the last chapter too. Remember, we have this problem of if the brain's predicting ahead what everything that's happening, it's sort of hard to intervene in real time, but you can start to curate new experiences, is the way she said it. Or with our Yogacara Buddhist model, start to plant wholesome seeds for the future, you know, seeds of connection, seeds of understanding. We can start to shift this. But I don't know, it kind of helped, it frees me up. I think for me, it makes it feel more possible to say, oh, okay. Part of what prevents me here is not just my white privilege and all those things, but neurology, you know? And I can do something about it. Because in my thinking mind, and I'm sure yours too, I feel like I'm an open person, you know, appreciate all kinds of people. But if I look at my behavior, I have not sought out much contact with other cultures around us. I mean, I've been open to it if it popped up, but I've not sought it out. Like in Bellingham, one of our neighbors are a sovereign nation, you know, a couple of our neighbors are sovereign nations that have lived in the area for 12,000 plus years. I mean, that's incredible, right? The Lummi Nation, the Nooksack Nation, other tribal groups. And I've read and appreciated about Native American studies, you know. Maybe that's within my co-regulated universe. It's easy to read about things while I'm home, you know. But I've not really sought out contact and connection. I know some of us have more than me. I just am recognizing I need to own that and not have it be a matter of, oh, I'll get around to it sometime, I'm busy. Because especially in the last decade or so, in the case of the Lummi Nation, they've been making an effort, you know. They've been having public events, canoe journeys, totem pole journeys, blessing ceremonies. They've actually been inviting, and I haven't been responding. So I noticed there's a blessing ceremony in a couple of weeks on Monday the 24th in the afternoon. one of the things the Lummis have done to try to gather support for the things that matter to them and therefore the things that matter to the planet is create a totem pole every year, every couple of years, I'm not even sure, and put it on a truck and drive it all around the country and take it to Washington, D.C., and, you know, as a way of communicating with the nation. And so they start here, you know. So there's a blessing ceremony for the latest totem pole journey on Monday the 24th. So I'm setting my intention to go. Hold me to it, if you would. And I notice it's the same thing, even with the bits of anti-racism education I've done. I've really appreciated what I've learned, and it's been surprising and shifting and deep, challenging. But I also notice my attention so easily goes somewhere else. I tell myself I'm busy or I'll get to it later. And I do a little bit, but it could certainly be more. Like, for instance, I took a whole class on all this offered in a Dharma context, you know, offered by the Zen community of Oregon. And they offered me the curriculum, and I've been meaning to share it with the Sangha. And so in the fall, I will. It's really great set of materials, very powerful, very interesting. And I've been sitting on it, you know, too busy. Busy like raising money for a new building or whatever. So I could come up with all kinds of reasons, but, and you probably have other ways that you're learning about this stuff. I know you're not waiting for me to provide it, but I have this opportunity to make that easier for some of us. So why don't I act and challenge my neurology a little bit? Also been working a little bit with a trainer in diversity, equity, inclusion, and his advice to me was, Tim, you got to get messy. So I'll try. Because this is our bodhisattva path, you know? How can our precepts really unfold if we limit ourselves to what's neurologically easy for us? And the cool thing, though, is there, it seems like there's a probable win-win in going forward with this, which is that as we become more connected and interconnected, open and accepting and able to co-regulate with other kinds of cultures and peoples, not to mention other species, right, and landscapes and the planet itself, then we're gaining like a whole bunch of new co-regulation partners, you know? Fantastic. So we should all live longer and be healthier and everything will be great. And at the least, it'll help a little in a terribly unjust world. Because the consequences, as we know, of not doing this can be really frightening and horrible. Like I'm sure you remember well that on March 16th of this year, a young man named Robert Long went to the gun store and bought himself a gun, and visited several massage parlors in the Atlanta, Georgia area, and started shooting. And in the end, 8 people were dead, 6 of them Asian women who were massage therapists at these spas. And while I don't think we can ever get into the heads of these of our unfortunate shooters, or understand why they did what they did, or if why is even a question that makes sense, there were for sure warning signs that this particular person, Robert Long, had a greater degree of separateness than the average person. Warning signs around extreme evangelical type views and sex addiction and the background of anti-Asian violence has been rising strongly in America since COVID was discovered. Polls have shown that more than half of Asian people, Asian Americans and Asians living in America, say that they're experiencing an increase in overt racism. And as you know, there's a long and getting longer horrible list of random violence against Asian people. So the consequences of this neurological separateness are big. And we did have the eight victims from Atlanta on our well-being and memorial list, and we chanted their names every day for 49 days in the morning practices, which is at least something. And another beautiful response to this horror was an important Buddhist memorial ceremony that was held on the 49th day in LA. There are quite a few Buddhist centers and a large Asian population, Asian American. And it was organized by a fellow Soto Zen teacher, Duncan Ryokan Williams, who also wrote a really powerful book about the internment experience as a religious discriminative experience. And he organized it with many other Asian Buddhist leaders and sanghas down there. And they called the event, May We Gather. May We Gather. So may we come together. May we let our brains come together, our souls come together, our hearts come together. And let that be the response to horror and tragedy, discrimination and prejudice. May we be Sangha, you know, and may we practice seeing people from other cultures as beautiful, dignified Buddhas. So they did a great job video recording this event. And since we're on Zoom, I want to take advantage of that and spend pretty much the rest of the Dharma Talk time sharing a few excerpts of this amazing ceremony with you. And I can send out the links. You can watch the whole thing. It was almost 2 hours long. So I just picked out a few little excerpts to give you the flavor of it. And, does religious practice change things? I think that's where we tend to have this sort of materialistic view that like, oh, that's just religion or that's just, you know, nice or something. But since all of our actions stem from our mind, and our mind seems to stem from our brain, as neuroscience is suggesting, that we will make different choices if we curate intercultural experiences and other positive experiences. Maybe this is very directly helping with the problem, helping with this horror. So let me see if I can bring this up on the screen and share it with you. Ba-ba-bum. So that's the right top. Screen. Okay, I'm just going to turn it on and off for a second, and if you can thumbs up if you can hear the sound. It's never quite clear to me when Zoom is going to share the sound. You hear bells and chanting? Cool. So it opens with chanting by the Japanese leaders of the host sangha. But I'll try not to explain too much and just play excerpts.
Sang Buddhist Memorial for Asian American Ancestors. We extend our deepest gratitude to Higashi Honganji Buddhist Temple in Little Tokyo, Los Angeles, for hosting today's ceremony. As many of you know, just 2 months and 8 days ago, this temple was vandalized. We stand here now thanks to the groundswell of community support that has helped restore the temple. We also acknowledge that we are standing on Tongva territory. This stolen land has borne witness to the physical and spiritual violence of 5 centuries of colonialism, and it has also sustained indigenous rituals for countless generations. We pay respect to these native ancestors and to the tribal communities who, in the face of displacement and genocide, have maintained their religious practices to the present day. Today, May 4th, 2021, marks the 49th day since 8 people, 6 of them women of Asian descent, were killed in a mass shooting in Georgia. In many Buddhist traditions, the 49th day after death is an important moment of transition for both the deceased and the bereaved. Our collective grief is likewise shaped by the horrors of the coronavirus pandemic, which has claimed the lives of over 3 million people around the globe, including nearly 600,000 Americans. The virus continues to ravage communities across this country and in South and Southeast Asia, laying bare the violence of domestic and global inequities. The virus has also been used as a racist justification for many of the recent incidents of anti-Asian violence. Indeed, racial animus against Asians in the United States and beyond has long been shaped by fears of contagion. Our bodies have been unjustly blamed for the work of microscopic vectors. We wish that everyone who wanted to be here in person could join us. The virus has made this impossible. Here in this temple and across the country online, we will make merit together today. Even though we must be physically distanced, our united intention brings us together in spiritual community.
Our gathering brings together American Buddhist leaders from Chinese, Japanese, Khmer, Korean, Taiwanese, Tibetan, Sri Lankan, Thai, and Vietnamese Buddhist traditions. We will chant sacred texts, transfer merit to Asian American Buddhist ancestors, and pray for the peace and protection of all beings. We will share 6 Dharma messages on each of the paramis, or paramitas, the perfected qualities of awakened beings. We gather as Asian American Buddhists and allies in an expression of our fundamental interconnectedness. We do not suffer alone, nor do we heal alone. Only when we join together as a Sangha can we truly support each other's freedom. When our Chinese immigrant ancestors came to these shores in the 1850s, we faced exclusion and violence. Our Buddhist and Taoist temples desecrated and set ablaze. When our Japanese Americans American forebears were herded into U.S. concentration camps in the 1940s, our priests were classified as a threat to national security, our Buddhist faith deemed un-American. When our South and Southeast Asian parents and grandparents arrived in this country in the 1970s, many fleeing wars inflamed by the American military, we were told our cultures and Buddhist traditions didn't belong. In the face of nearly two centuries of xenophobia and systemic violence, Asian American Buddhists have long joined together to rebuild our communities. Piece by broken piece, we sutured the jagged edges of altars, statues, incense burners, and our very bodies and minds back together. This mending is part of our Buddhist practice in America. Each act of rejoining reveals how compassion can arise out of racial suffering, how fragments are inseparable from wholeness. We mend them as a declaration of our interconnectedness, as an expression of gratitude to our ancestors, and as a way to cultivate the karmic conditions for American Buddhism's continued flourishing. As we confront yet another wave of violence, vandalism, and exclusion targeting Asian Americans and Asian American Buddhists, let us honor our ancestors by continuing their legacy of gathering and mending.
We would now like to share a short video of Elliot and Robert Peterson recalling memories of their mother, Young Ae Yu, a Korean Buddhist killed in the Atlanta area shootings. Their words are a powerful reminder of the impact of violence and discrimination on an individual and family level.
She was a funny woman. She was a phenomenal woman. She was a family woman. Like I said, she got most of her joy from being around me and my brother and the grandkids and cooking. And food is what really brought our families together.
She was very traditional Korean mother. She was big on education for her children, for her grandchildren. She was big on being respectful. And at the same time, she was very direct. You know, she didn't sugarcoat a lot of things, but a very strong Korean cultured woman is how I remember my mother.
Well, my mother was selfless, right? It was about others. It was less about her. She always tell you she'd be okay. Don't worry about me. She didn't ask or need for much. She didn't have much either, but she gave all that she did have. They had not yet identified the bodies, but I think at that point they had released that the four women were Korean women. I called the medical examiner, and that's when she told me that they have somebody down there with my mother's name and birthday. And I think at that same moment, my brother was calling to check on me and to see if I heard anything. And I had literally just found out, and he was calling. And he tells me he remembers what I said. Yeah. That it's gonna play in his head forever, you know?
Yeah. He said, Lamont, it was her.
It was my mama's. Some people ask, am I black and Korean? I'm black and Korean, right? I have an African-American father and a Korean mother. And my mother was very adamant about knowing both, right? I didn't have to do one exclusively without the other. One was not more valuable than the other. Again, she was very much conscious of what I looked like aesthetically on the outside, what me and my brother looked like. Again, African-American presenting. She also recognized I grew up in America. And discrimination against Asians and African Americans is a part of the American fabric, right? So this is not new.
My mother, she know we faced it. We faced discrimination on both sides growing up. You know, there have been some people we were around that didn't like her Asian culture or her Asian children. And then at the same time, there were other groups that didn't like the brown color of the skin, black culture. of us. But my mom was always an advocate of treating people right. Always not letting us know not to be embarrassed of who we were. Always ready to stand up and speak about discrimination if she saw you actively discriminating. Now you can see how great my mother was. You sure can.
Venerable Aparekha Punyasiri of Maitri Vihara in Sun Valley, California, will now chant the Three Refuges in Pali, along with a group of Theravada monastics. After we take refuge in the triple gem of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, Reverend Duncan Ryuken Williams of Zen Shuji Soto Mission in Little Tokyo, Los Angeles, will deliver the Hyo Byakumon, a pronouncement before the Buddha about the intention of today's gathering.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami, dhammam saranam gacchami, sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami.
The Buddha taught that even if you scour the world, there's not a single person who has not experienced loss from the death of someone they love. This sense of loss is only compounded when a loved one passes away suddenly or violently. 49 days ago, 8 families experienced this aggravated sense of grief when 8 people, 6 of them Asian women, were shot and killed in the Atlanta, Georgia area. We gather today because only through joining together do we know that we are not alone. In ceremony, loss can be transformed into connection, including connection with those we believe are absent. The Buddha himself told his community just before he died that while he would no longer be physically present, he would still be with them through his teaching and his example. Indeed, the Buddha is with us in this present moment. He is here through his teachings, which links the past to the present and each of us to one another. Death may be thought of as a loss, but in the customary 49 days of mourning after a person's passing, we come to learn from the deceased just how present they are in our hearts and minds, our bones and marrow. Like the Buddha, they teach us that our lives are inexorably interlinked. This gathering was prompted by the life and death of young A.U., a devout Korean-American Buddhist whose life was cut short at the aromatherapy spa in Atlanta. Her two sons remember her as a selfless person who stood up against discrimination and always advocated for treating people right. She reminds us that the antidote to a gunman's confused and deluded mind is the wisdom to see things clearly. Her offering to the nation includes this very gathering, which brings together an American Sangha from many lineages and many regions of our country. As with the life, death, and memory of George Floyd, we learn that the power of one life can touch the hearts of so many. Ignorance and confusion were also the root causes that led to the killing of Tommy Lee, a Vietnamese American who was shot to death by police in Seattle. Police claimed that Tommy held a knife in his hands. Those claims were proven to be false. He was simply knocking on a door with a pen. During his 49th day Buddhist ceremony, Tommy's family placed his photo on the temple altar, alongside photos of dozens more people who had passed on, firm in their belief that ceremony is not about one life, but about many lives in spiritual community. That through the life of Tommy Lee, we are reminded of Dante Wright, shot by police in Minnesota during a routine traffic stop 3 weeks ago. The police officer claimed she intended to use a taser on him instead of a pistol. Tommy and Dante become present every time we work to provide safety to all members of our community in wiser and more compassionate ways. This poison of ignorance runs deep. If we go back in time to the World War II era, we find an entire ethnic group, including members of this very temple where we are holding our ceremony now, targeted out of ignorance. Japanese American Buddhists constituted the largest Buddhist community in the United States at the time of the Pearl Harbor attack. Temples were under government surveillance, priests arrested by the FBI as threats to national security, and over 120,000 Japanese American community members were eventually herded into America's concentration camps because of our faith and our race. Among those incarcerated and displaced was Kanesaburo Oshima, taken from his home in Kona, Hawaii, and shot by a U.S. Army guard in the back of his neck at the Fort Sill internment camp in Oklahoma. He stood at the fence line, surrounded by barbed wire, wishing only to be reunited with his wife and 11 children who held his funeral at the Daifukuji Soto Mission. Today, his granddaughter, who serves as the Buddhist priest of that very temple, joins us in ceremony. Kanesaburo Oshima teaches us about how the Buddhist virtues of patience and persistence extends beyond generations. This lineage of racial hurt sometimes moves beyond mere ignorance and confusion to hostility and even hatred. We recall the name Vicha Ratanapakdi, our Thai Buddhist immigrant elder, assaulted while taking his daily walk in his San Francisco neighborhood. We feel the impact of his head hitting the pavement. We reel from the unprovoked, senseless assaults that have been inflicted on Ratanapakdi and so many of our Asian American community seniors in recent months. On the same streets, His daughter had been spat on by people as they accused her of bringing COVID to this country. The anti-Asian animus and violence is repeated as we recall Amarjit Sekhon, whose life was cut short by bullets at her workplace, the FedEx warehouse in Indianapolis, where six like her constituted the majority of the workforce. She left behind two sons who spoke of her working countless hours a week so she could provide food for everyone in the house. Vicha Ratanapakti's daughter hoped that telling her immigrant father's story might protect others. And we feel his and Amarjit Sekhon's presence today as a prayer and talisman against harm for all sentient beings. Religious racial hostility and outright hatred, also the result of delusion, runs deep in American history. On Super Bowl Sunday 1996, Tin Min Lee was in line skating at a tennis court in Tustin, California, while visiting his family. Since graduating from UCLA and Georgetown, he had hoped one day to serve as the Vietnamese American ambassador to Vietnam, his devout Buddhist family's ancestral land. We still recoil as we remember his death at the hands of an avowed white supremacist who bragged in a letter about this murder enacted on behalf of a racist ideology. His brother recalls reading and almost fully memorizing that letter and returning to the site of the murder, unable to comprehend the hatred that ended Lee's life. That hatred is old as the earliest records of American Buddhist history, established in our nation by Chinese immigrants. Among them, we recall Xiao Bunnan, who was among 28 Chinese miners massacred in Rock Springs, Wyoming in 1885 by those who believed that Chinese immigrants were taking jobs away from white miners. He was among those found dead in a burnt out hut next to the Budo Daoist temple. His community was branded with the slur words, the heathen Chini, and deemed a racially unassimilable and religiously unacceptable community in America. We feel these burning wounds even today. Tian Min Li and Xia Bun Ning's lives have been teaching all of us how to hold ourselves with dignity in the face of supremacist and exclusionary ideologies. The poisons of ignorance, greed, and hatred have precipitously ended the lives of so many. We gather together to provide an antidote, wisdom to heal ignorance, loving kindness to heal hatred, and generosity to heal greed. This powerful medicine is available to us right whenever the need arises. The black abolitionist Frederick Douglass provided a powerful diagnosis and healing when he insisted in a speech that America is a composite nation. A former enslaved person himself, he gave a speech nearly 20 years before Xia Bun Ning's death about the rising agitation nationwide against the Chinese American community and how the struggle for emancipation was interlinked to immigrant inclusion. The America he envisioned was one that welcomed the Chinese and immigrants from a multitude of races and faiths to the duties of citizenship, a vision of America that values multiplicity over singularity, hybridity over purity, and inclusivity over exclusivity. As we see ourselves in others, and others see us in them, we learn the lessons of those for whom we perform the ceremony. Together, we join today to repair the racial karma of this nation, because our destinies and freedoms are intertwined. And though the mountain of suffering is high and the tears of pain fill the deepest oceans, our path compels us to rise up like a lotus flower above muddy waters. Medicine also comes from a saying attributed to Bodhidharma, Nanakoro Biyaoki, fall down seven times, get up eight. At times, this means we come back to our breath when our mind wanders, or sit up straight when we slump off the meditation cushion. Other times, we return to our precepts and vows when we fall off the noble path. but sometimes it requires us to gather. And today, we, the Sangha of the United States of America, have gathered to recall our interconnectedness, feel the presence of those who have gone before us, and to get back up. And though we may fall a million times, we rise again a million and one times in honor of our ancestors and our loved ones who have passed. May we gather.
I was trying to find the next spot, but it's more about out of time anyway, so let's see. Screen share stuff. Okay. So just a lot of wonderful chanting and rituals and little talks they did in that ceremony. I'll get the link out to you, and hopefully you have time to look at it. There was an interesting connection made between the 49-day period and the six paramitas. There's little short talks on all six paramitas, too. It's all quite incredible. So, we, the Sangha of the United States of America, may we gather. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Let's do our bows. The Thai monks already chanted the refuges for us, so we can appreciate their beautiful chanting. Bow out. Yeah.